We're going to pick up in Genesis chapter 29. Just these last five verses is what we left off a couple of weeks ago. And in verse 31, we start to have this issue. Do you remember where we are? For those of you that weren't with us a couple of weeks ago, Jacob, remember, got deceived into essentially consummating a marriage relationship with a sister that he didn't want to marry. And Laban took advantage of him for that. And so he's married to Leah now. Doesn't even love the girl, poor girl. And then after he finishes out the marriage week with her, then he gets to take Rachel as his wife, who's the one he wanted to marry in the first place. So he's already been deceived by his father-in-law. A little bit of some of the same stuff he pulled on his brother and father. And so here he is now, and he's married to these two sisters, and that's not a good recipe, by the way, for domestic tranquility, by the way. People will ask from time to time, why is it God allowed polygamy to take place in the Bible? I don't know. Ask God. But I'll tell you one thing. I'll tell you one thing I do know. God allowed the people who were engaged in it to deal with the difficult side of it. And Jacob is in this whirlpool of just jealousy and catfighting, and it gets really weird. Look at verse 31. It says, "When the Lord saw that Leah was not loved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren." Oh, now this is, you can tell right now we've set the stage for just absolute turmoil in the house, because who's going to start having babies? The woman that isn't loved. Who is not going to be able to have babies for quite a season? The woman who is loved. And so, and these girls know what's going on, and yet the power of having children that is going to be given to Leah here is absolutely amazing. And it's going to create all kinds of turmoil in the home. Let me tell you, this honeymoon ain't lasting long. That's the bottom line. And so it says in verse 32 that Leah became pregnant and gave birth to a son, and she named him Reuben, for she said, "It is because the Lord has seen my misery." And so the name Reuben kind of sounds like the Hebrew for "seen my misery." Can you imagine naming a kid something that sounds like something? You know, how do you even do that? I'm not even sure, but there you go. So she says in the middle of verse 32, and this is kind of sad. She says, "Surely my husband will love me now." And she conceived again. And when she gave birth to a son, she said, "Because the Lord heard that I am not loved, he gave me this one too." And so she named him Simeon. And Simeon, we're not exactly sure what it means. We think it means something like "one who hears." And in verse 34, it says, again she conceived. Now, Rachel's got no action going on here. And Leah is turning into a veritable baby factory. It says, after she conceived, and when she gave birth to a son, she said in verse 34, "Now at last my husband will become attached to me, because I have borne him three sons." So he was named Levi. And it sounds like, and in fact, your footnotes tell you that it may actually be a derivative from the Hebrew for the word "attached." But look at what's going on here. Isn't this sad? I mean, it's this competition going on within the home. And Leah knows that her husband doesn't love her, and yet she's having relations with him, and she's bearing children, and she's born three boys. That's a big deal in that culture. Three boys is like just amazing. Well, and she's not even going to be done. But after each child is born, there's this hopeful statement, you know, that maybe now he's going to pay attention to me in some sort of a loving and compassionate way, because she was not loved. You know, we talked about this a few weeks ago when I brought up that passage from Ephesians chapter 5, which basically tells us that of all the things that a man can do for his wife, the Bible says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church, because that is her primary need. Being the relational creature that she is, being connected to those relationships, and particularly no more intimate relationship than with her husband. It says, husbands, love your wives. Make sure that she knows that she's loved, or she's going to be a miserable woman. We looked at that proverb that even said as much. It said that it is an unbearable situation for a married woman to be unloved. And it's because God has placed within the woman that need. That need and desire and so forth to be loved and cared for. And Leah didn't have any of that. And so she's trying to compensate now with giving birth to these children. And again, with each child that is born, she's expressing her hope and desire that her husband is somehow going to begin to show her the kind of love that a wife ought to receive. And it says in verse 35 that she conceived again. And when she gave birth to a son, she said, "This time I will praise the Lord." And so she named him Judah. And once again, Judah sounds like and could be derived from the Hebrew for praise. But then it says she stopped having children, at least for a while. So then we move in to Genesis chapter 30. So now she's got this brood of boys. Again, Rachel has nothing. And it says when Rachel saw that she was not bearing Jacob any children, she became jealous of her sister. Well, you know, that probably happened almost right away. The jealousy begins. And jealousy is one of the worst things that can happen, you know, in a person's heart. So what is she going to do? Middle of verse 1, it says, so she came to her husband. She said to Jacob, "Give me children or I'll die." She's putting the burden on him for this whole thing. And I want you to notice how Jacob responds to her. It says that Jacob became angry and he said, "Am I in the place of God who has kept you from having children?" He throws it completely onto God. And, you know, yeah, be that as it may, he's not responding in the loving way that he should now to even this woman that he does love and have affection for. You'll remember that his father dealt with the very same issue. Isaac, we're told, looked upon his wife Rebekah and realized that she was not conceiving. She was not able to have children either. And what does it say that he did? He prayed for her. He didn't wait for her to get so frustrated that she came to him out of just this absolute, you know, emotional turmoil that she's going through. But he prayed ahead of time. Isaac prayed ahead of time. It says he sought the Lord on behalf of his wife, and it says, and God heard him, and Rebekah conceived. Now, that's the attitude I think God wants men to have. We're, you know, here's the tough part for us men, and you ladies probably, and I don't want to say this in a way of making it sound like I'm making excuses, but I think it's important for the women to hear anyway. Men are some of the most frustrated lovers on the face of the earth. I mean, we just are. We want to love our wives, but we are frustrated because we're such dope heads sometimes. And we have a difficult time discerning the needs that are really there. And or maybe it's just me, all right? I'll let the rest of you guys off the hook. I'm the big dope head here. But just that ability to discern those needs ahead of time, that's hard. That's hard because we're kind of busy doing what we're doing, you know? And you know, anyway. I got to pray, Lord, just give me, you know, that insight. And I love how Isaac had that kind of insight that he prayed for his wife. Jacob, on the other hand, was a man who did not pray for his wife. Here he is having babies with her sister, for heaven's sakes. Not attending to the, you know, but again, Jacob isn't at a place in his life where he's praying about much of anything. He's in that manipulative stage. He's in that I'm going to take care of it myself stage. Well, what does a guy do when he's in the I'll take care of it myself stage, but he can't take care of it? What does he do? You know what, ladies? You know what he does? He gets angry. That's the way guys respond when they're in that realm of I'm going to do it myself, but I can't do it myself. That's what guys do. They get angry. Because men don't like to be in a situation where they feel helpless. We hate it. Like the plague. And we'll avoid it at all costs. And that's why men will stay away from doing things that they're intimidated to do. That's why a lot of guys never rise up and become the spiritual leader of their home. They feel intimidated. They don't want to even set out for fear of failure. And so they just don't do anything. They just kind of sit back and they let the woman just kind of take care of it. And it's a real challenge for guys. And then when they're confronted, when the wife finally gets tired of taking the lead, she says, why don't you do a little spiritual leading around here? What does he do, ladies? He gets mad, doesn't he? Yeah, he corks off, you know, and just says something like, yeah, well, you know, whatever, he throws something or whatever, and you know, and then you got a real fun time going on in your home, you know? And that's Jacob. That's what Jacob's doing because he's in that situation. And frankly, Rachel is even provoking him further by her comment. Do you know that? She said, I mean, look what she says to him. Give me a baby. I want a baby. Or I'll die. And Jacob is already in, he's already well down the road in this mode of, I got to take care of it. And she's saying, do this. And he can't. There's nothing he can do. I mean, back in those days, a man could only do so much. And it wasn't working. So what are you going to do? So Rachel's actually provoking him here too. Rather than saying, would you beseech the face of your God that I might have a child? I mean, that probably would have come off a little bit better because it would have been a recognition right away from the get-go. I know you can't do anything about this yourself, but have you thought about maybe doing what your dad did and just going to God? And you know what, guys? We need to take a page out of Isaac's book of how to take care of your wife. When you are faced with a situation for which there's really nothing you can do, humanly speaking, go to the Lord. Don't let it go on so long that she finally is so frustrated that she provokes you into some kind of an attitude of anger because you haven't done your job of recognizing the need and going to God and saying, you know what, God, there's nothing I can do to help my wife in this. You know that. There's nothing I can do. My hands are, they're tied. Lord, this has got to be a work of your grace. You know? That's the lesson that we men need to learn. So, in verse 3, she decides, because she's probably taking a page out of Jacob's book, got to get this done myself. Then she said, fine, I'm not going to have any children. Here's Bilhah, my maidservant. Sleep with her so that you can bear children for me. And that through her too, or through her I too can build a family. And so she gave him her servant Bilhah as a wife, and Jacob slept with her. And she became pregnant and bore him a son. And then Rachel said, God has vindicated me. Yeah, I don't think so. But she says, God has vindicated me. He has listened to my plea and given me a son. And because of this, she named him Dan. Isn't this interesting? This human propensity that we have to set out in our own strength to do our own thing, to accomplish our own purpose. And then when it goes our way, we say, praise the Lord. And you know what we do? We kind of drag his name through the mud. You know? Because we're giving credit to God for something that frankly goes against his purpose and will for our lives in the first place. We know as we get into the New Testament that it was never God's intention for a man to have more than one wife. We know that. Jesus clears up that matter in the New Testament. He said to the people listening to him, have you not read that in the beginning? You know, and then he begins to quote that passage from Genesis chapter 2, verses 18 and following, which ends with this statement, therefore the two shall become one. Not 3, 4, 5, 6, 10. And so Jesus affirms that God's original purpose for marriage was one man, one woman. That's what makes a marriage. God bore with some things that were clearly out of his will. But for Rachel to come away and kind of begin to praise God, you know, because she took matters into her own hands, you know, is really kind of ridiculous when you stop and think about it, you know. It's a manipulative sort of an arrangement. And really, it's no different than what Grandma Sarah did when she gave her maidservant Hagar to Abraham and said, here, let's have a son through Hagar. And God had to finally approach and confront them and say, that's not my plan. I told you you were going to have a baby through Sarah. And that's what I meant. So stop taking this thing into your own hands and thinking I need help to fulfill my will. You know? And that's really kind of what it comes down to. We want to help God. God, move over a little bit here. Let me help. Let me get this thing done. You're not moving fast enough, by the way. And that's kind of what we're really saying. And for Rachel, and frankly, this thing was manipulated. It started off by their father Laban, you know, putting Leah in the marriage bed with Jacob instead of his intended, which was Rachel. And then Jacob is thrust into this situation where he's now married to these two girls, and there's this infighting and jealousy, and it just creates this cesspool of difficulty in the home. And it really is a terrible situation. So she gives him, you know, her servant Bilhah and so forth. And there you go. She names him Dan, which means he has vindicated. Verse 7, Rachel's servant Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. And then Rachel said, I've had a great struggle with my sister and I have won. I'm not really sure how she figures that out exactly. I mean, I'm not sure how she's kind of counting this thing since Leah has herself had babies, you know, and she's now had two with her through her, you know, through kind of almost like a surrogate situation. But she's congratulating herself now on winning the contest. And so she names him Naphtali, which means my struggle. And when Leah saw that she had stopped having children, she took her maidservant Zilpah and gave her to Jacob as a wife. And Leah's servant Zilpah bore Jacob a son. And then Leah said, oh, what good fortune. And so she named him Gad because it kind of like means good fortune. And it also can mean a troop. It's like I have a troop of kids too. But and then it says, Leah's servant Zilpah bore Jacob a second son. And then Leah said, how happy I am. The women will call me happy. And so she named him Happy, which is the meaning of Asher. How would you like to be living in this home? Yeah. Yeah, this is a weird one, isn't it? These are the kind of people that end up on afternoon television arguing paternity issues. Verse 14 says, and it gets even a little more dramatic. During wheat harvest, Reuben, who's obviously, you know, growing up, went out into the fields and found some mandrake plants. I'll explain that in a minute, which he brought to his mother Leah. Rachel said to Leah, please give me some of your son's mandrakes. But she said to her, wasn't it enough that you took away my husband? Will you take my son's mandrakes too? Now that's a catty statement, isn't it? I mean, because, you know, she knows that Jacob intended to marry Rachel and Leah just ended up in the marriage bed, you know, by deception. And yet she's treating her sister like, again, this competition thing is going on. And so, middle of verse 15, very well, Rachel said, he can sleep with you tonight in return for your son's mandrake. So now they're bargaining. Verse 16, so when Jacob came in from the fields that evening, Leah went out to meet him. You must sleep with me, she said. I've hired you with my son's mandrakes. So he slept with her that night. I mean, again, this is just getting, it's going from weird to ridiculous. Now, okay, what's the deal with mandrakes? Well, the mandrake plant is a root, and it is apparently known, and this, I read this, I can't personally vouch for this, but I read that the mandrake root is known in some places in Hebrew as love apples. I'm sorry, I know it sounds weird, but they were thought supposedly to, and in some cases I'm hearing that they still are considered a way to increase fertility in women. I can't vouch for it. I don't know if it's true. But because Leah had these mandrakes, which her son Reuben had brought in from the field, apparently Rachel wanted them in such a way as to increase her own fertility, but she purchased from that these mandrakes by giving her husband into Anyway. And it says in verse 17 that God listened to Leah and she became pregnant and bore Jacob a fifth son. And then Leah said, God has rewarded me for giving my maidservant to my husband. There it is again. God has rewarded me. Isn't that something? Just because God is gracious and merciful and he doesn't strike us dead on the spot for the things that we do, we think he's rewarding us. This is a reward from God. You know? So that means if I rob you at gunpoint and I go buy something good for somebody and give it to them, God has rewarded me for taking your money. That's ridiculous. It's just this sort of this circumstantial approach to discerning the will of God. And do you know that there are Christians who do the same thing? I mean, we laugh, we chuckle, but do you know Christians do this too? They are entirely moved by circumstances as it relates to discerning and understanding the will of God. If things go well, that was God's will. If things don't go well, that wasn't God's will. And that kind of, you know, rationalizing for the will of God is not found in the Bible. Circumstances can be a way for God to move us, and he'll do that. He'll move us into situations where he wants us to go. But usually it's not it's kind of like the squeeze play. I've seen God put the squeeze play on people lots of times. And what that means is he's telling somebody he wants them to go there. And so in order to get there, because they're so stubborn, he has to dry up everything here. But it's not like they're even looking for the will of God. They're actually resisting the will of God. So he has to dry up things where they are, so they'll go, well, I got to go somewhere now. And God will do that in people's lives who are struggling to submit to the will of God. I've seen that happen many times. I've even seen it happen in my own life. I've seen God use circumstances to put the squeeze play on me just because I was like too thick-headed and completely unresponsive to the Holy Spirit. He's probably speaking to me all over the place, but he's like, well, he's not listening. All right, squeeze play. You know, I'm just going to dry up this little place where he's kind of standing, so he's going to have to move on. It happens. You know, we saw it happen. We saw it happen with Isaac. Isaac went to go live at a place he wasn't supposed to live. And so eventually God started putting the squeeze play on him with the Philistines. They start, you know, harassing him. And they say, move out of town. So he moves out of town. Then he starts having more harassing stuff going on from the Philistines there. Remember with the wells? And so he was like, okay. You know, he started moving his... Pretty soon he got back where God wanted him to be. You know? Just because, you know, when we're not listening, God will use those things. But let me tell you something. It can be a really, really dangerous way of saying, I know God's will. Because this is going good or this is going bad. That's just, you know, we live in a fallen world. And Paul the Apostle never, you know, I mean, if he ran into a wall, he'd just turn around and go a different direction. You know, he didn't stop and go, oh, I guess God doesn't want me to be an apostle after all. They threw rocks at me. And those people over there, you know, they ran me out of town on a rail. I guess God doesn't want me to be an apostle after all. You know what Paul did? He just said, you know what? We have to go through many trials to enter the kingdom of God. He considered it par for the course. You know? So anyway. So she says, you know, God rewarded her and she named him Issachar, which means reward. Verse 19. Boy, she's not done. Leah conceived again and bore Jacob a sixth son. And then Leah said, God has presented me with a precious gift. This time my husband will treat me with honor because I've borne him six sons. So she named him Zebulun, which we're not really sure. We think it means honor. But anyway, isn't this interesting? She's now had six babies and she's still not being treated correctly. And that's why she's saying, maybe now he'll treat me with honor. Which, what does that tell you? He's not. He's not treating her. She's got a brood of six boys. You know, there's probably women at that time who would have killed for six boys, you know, or for half that. It's really amazing. And then, not to any kind of a slight on women, but it says in verse 21, sometime later she gave birth to a daughter and named her Dinah. Anyway, and it just kind of moves on. It's kind of one of those things like, and she named her Dinah, which probably means like, oops, I don't know. Exactly, but it doesn't really say a whole lot. Doesn't even say why she named her that. It's just Dinah, and Dinah, frankly, is going to play into the lives of these men as they grow older. It says in verse 22, then God remembered Rachel. He listened to her and opened her womb, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. and said, God has taken away my disgrace. And she named him Joseph and said, may the Lord add to me another son. Joseph means, may he add. And after Rachel gave birth to Joseph, Jacob said to Laban, send me on my way so I can go back to my home, my own homeland. Give me my wives and children for whom I have served you, and I will be on my way. You know how much work I've done for you. But Laban said to him, if I found favor in your eyes, please stay. Look at Laban's comment here. I have learned by divination that the Lord has blessed me because of you. And he added, name your wages and I'll pay them. Now this is Laban. Once again, he's using circumstances to the best of his, you know, benefit. And he's basically saying to Jacob, I am getting rich because you're here. And at first I wasn't really sure it was you, but I've used divination, which means he had gone to a spiritist in the land to determine why he was becoming wealthy. And he learned by divination that it was because of Jacob, because of Jacob's presence. And you say, well, what kind of divination did they use? All kinds of things. You've heard of reading tea leaves and you know, like tarot cards. Well, back in those days, they would do all kinds of weird things to divine the truth of a situation. All kinds of strange things in pagan sort of, you know, thought processes. But the point is, he says, I've learned that it's because of you that I'm being blessed, so I want you to stay. So name your wages. And Jacob said to him, you know how I've worked for you and your livestock has fared under my care. So the little you had before I came has increased greatly, and the Lord has blessed you wherever I have been. But now, when may I do something for my own household? Verse 31, what shall I give you? He asked. I love Jacob's response here. It's really good. He says, don't give me anything. Jacob replied, but if you will do this one thing for me, I will go on tending your flocks and watching over them. Let me go through all your flocks today and remove from them every speckled or spotted sheep, every dark-colored lamb, and every spotted or speckled goat, and they will be my wages. And my honesty will testify for me in the future. Whenever you check on the wages you've paid me, any goat in my possession that is not speckled or spotted, or any lamb that is not dark colored, will be considered stolen. Now you gotta think, you know, this is really smart of Jacob. I mean, this is really smart bargaining. From the standpoint, and we're gonna learn this later on, that Laban had been constantly changing their terms. And he'll bring that out later on in the next chapter. And that was because Laban was a man who manipulated. He was just like Jacob. He manipulated people, and if he thought it wasn't going to his benefit, he would just kind of turn things around and go, all right, now this is the new way we're doing it. Well, and he probably suspected Jacob on several fronts. And so Jacob really came up with an amazing plan to keep this thing on the up and up. Doesn't mean they're not going to become jealous of him, because they will when he becomes blessed. But he says, you know, hey, all the animals that are, you know, spotted, speckled, streaked, those are my wages. And Laban probably figures, yeah, that's a fair deal. Well, in fact, he does. And he says in verse 34, he says, agreed. In fact, he says, let it be as you've said. And that same day, they removed all the male goats and that were streaked and spotted, all the speckled or spotted female goats, all those that had white on them, and all the dark-colored lambs. And he, meaning, he placed them in the care of his sons, and then he put a three-day journey between himself and Jacob, while Jacob continued to tend the rest of Laban's flock. Now Jacob, however, check this out. This is really funny. Talk about the master manipulator. Jacob, however, took fresh-cut branches from poplar, almond, and plane trees, and made white strips on them by peeling the bark and exposing the white inner wood of the branches. And by the way, there's a little play on words here, because the Hebrew for the white inner branches, or white inner, is the name Laban. So it's just a little weird kind of wacky play on words. But anyway, it says, then he placed the peeled branches in all the watering troughs so that they would be directly in front of the flocks when they came to drink. And when the flocks were in heat and came to drink, they mated in front of the branches, and they bore young that were streaked or speckled or spotted. You didn't know that's how you got those kind of animals, did you? It's just branches. Go home and try it. Yeah. Anyway, So Jacob set apart the young of the flock by themselves, but made the rest face the streak and dark-colored animals that belonged to Laban. Thus he made separate flocks for himself and did not put them with Laban's animals. And whenever stronger females were in heat, Jacob would place the branches in the troughs in front of the animals so they would mate near the branches. But if the animals were weak, he would not place them there, so the weak animals went to Laban and the strong ones to Jacob. You know, it's just interesting, isn't it? I mean, you can call it selective breeding or you can call it manipulation. But either way, Jacob is kind of, he's still just taking things into his own hands. Now, we're going to see here in just a very short period of time that his attitude, even though he's still doing, he's pulling stunts like this, his attitude is going to change. And in fact, God is going to give him a dream that is going to clear it all up for him. Right now we're hearing about the streak-spotted, speckled way of getting these animals, which is, you know, peeling back the bark from branches. Yeah, right. God is going to clear all this up in a little while, and he's going to basically tell Jacob, listen, it was me, buddy. If you were having, if the animals were giving birth to, you know, spotted, streaked, and speckled, it was me. It was me blessing you. And I've seen how Laban's been treating you and so forth. So, but anyway, at this point, you know, Jacob's still kind of just doing things in his own wisdom and strength. And it says in verse 43 that in this way the man grew exceedingly prosperous and came to own large flocks, maid servants, and men servants, and camels and donkeys. We probably won't get through this whole next chapter, but I want to start some of this. In chapter 31, it says, Jacob heard that Laban's sons were saying, Jacob has taken everything our father owned and has gained all this wealth from what belonged to our father. Isn't it interesting? They can't complain with the method because the method is foolproof. But now they're just going to complain out of jealousy and envy and just say, well, you know, it was all ours to begin with. You know, he came here with nothing. Now he practically owns everything. He's like taking everything from our father. He hasn't taken anything. You know, God has been blessing the man. And they're refusing to see the reality of the situation as well. But that's what happens. You know, even when you create what appears to be a foolproof system of determining wages and recognizing the truthfulness of the exchange, it doesn't mean you're going to get rid of hard feelings. And that's exactly what's going on here. And in verse 2 it says, and Jacob also noticed now that Laban's attitude toward him was not what it had been. And no doubt that was because his sons poisoned his mind. You know, that's easily happens. You know, when people get jealous and they start just becoming discouraged and they start to complain, they probably went home and said the same thing to, you know, their dad. You know, what's this going on with Jacob? He's taking all your stuff. And over a period of time, you know, that wears on you, you know. Pretty soon you take on that attitude yourself. Bad company corrupts good character. Not that Laban ever had good character, but it's just kind of making things a little worse. And so now his attitude has changed. And in verse 3, it says, then the Lord said to Jacob, go back to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you. So Jacob sent word, and by the way, and this is kind of a squeeze play, but Jacob sent word to Rachel and Leah to come out to the fields where the flocks were. And he said to them, I see that your father's attitude toward me is not what it was before, but the God of my father has been with me. You know that I've worked for your father with all my strength, yet your father has cheated me by changing my wages 10 times. However, God has not allowed him to harm me. Ooh, wow. Looks like he's giving a little credit to God here. Yep, might be growing up just a bit. And if he said the speckled ones will be your wages, then all the flocks gave birth to speckled ones. And if he said the streaked ones will be your wages, then all the flocks bore streaked young. So God has taken away your father's livestock and given them to me. Wonder why he's saying this, saying that he's giving the credit to God. We'll see. In breeding season, look at this. I once had a dream in which I looked up and I saw that the male goats mating with the flock were streaked, speckled, or spotted. And the angel of God said to me in the dream, Jacob. And I answered, here I am. And he said, look up and see that all the male goats mating with the flock are streaked, speckled, and spotted. For I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now leave this land at once and go back to your native land. Well, now we see why Jacob's attitude has changed, or his perspective has changed. As we said before, God appeared to him and said, I am the God of your fathers. And he even showed him this picture of these animals mating in this dream as if to say to him, Jacob, it's not on the part of your own personal manipulation and your cleverness and your ability to strip back the bark of a branch that these things are taking place. This is my hand. And you'll notice as he's relating this now to his wives, he's saying the same thing. God has blessed me. Your father has cheated me. God has blessed me. It's pretty interesting, isn't it? But did you notice the progression here? Remember that squeeze play I was talking about? First, God gave Jacob the desire to go back home. We saw that, you know, in the last chapter where he came to Laban and said, let me take my stuff and go home. But Laban made that one last deal to keep him to there. But the desire has already been birthed in him to go home. But then, what does God allow to happen? He allows his circumstances to become unbearable. Why? He's putting the squeeze play on Jacob to get him back where he needs to be. It's time for him to go back. And then finally, the Lord is giving personal direction to Jacob in that dream, showing him that he is the one blessing him and then saying, now go home. Go home. And in verse 14, it says, then Rachel and Leah replied, do we still have any share in the inheritance of our father's estate? Does he not regard us as foreigners? Not only has he sold us, but he's used up what was paid for us. Surely all the wealth that God took away from our father belongs to us and our children. So do whatever God has told you to do. And then Jacob put his children and his wives on camels, and he drove all his livestock ahead of him, along with all the goods he had accumulated in Padan Aram, to go to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan. And when Laban had gone to shear his sheep, Rachel, just to kind of make matters worse, stole her father's household gods. Yeah, I mean, I know. It's kind of almost embarrassing, isn't it? Right after Jacob has met with his wives, and he's beginning to grow up a little bit to the point where he's realizing God's provision. And he's sharing that with his wives. He says, God has done this. God has done this. God has done this. And then what does Rachel do? She steals her father's household gods. These are like little statuette, idol thingies that he would bow down to. You know, the kind of stuff God forbade the Jews to be involved with in any way, shape, or form. So she steals these things. I don't know if it was to her a household, a lucky charm, or I don't know. We can't really get into her head to find out. But it says in verse 20, to make matters worse, the word is moreover, Jacob deceived Laban the Aramean by not telling him that he was running away. And that was a mistake on Jacob's part. He should have said something. And so he fled with all he had. And crossing the river, he headed for the hill country of Gilead. Now, the hill country of Gilead means that he's almost home. The hill country of Gilead is essentially that area on the other side of the Jordan that was not technically part of Israel, but was given to the tribes of Reuben and Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh. Remember that? Remember they were coming and they were getting ready to cross the Jordan, and these tribes said, hey, we want to keep this land here. And Moses was angry with them at first, thinking they were going to kind of drop out of the battle of clearing the land, and they said, oh no, we'll go into the land and we'll help these guys. But then when we're done, we'll come back and we'll settle here. Is that okay with you? And Moses gave him permission. Well, that's Gilead. That's, or we would call it Gad, you know, the region of Gad. Or remember, that's where Jesus went over. He crossed the river and went over to the area of the Gadarenes. That's where he was confronted with the man of the tombs and so forth, who had that legion of demons. Anyway, you kind of get an idea. It's close, but not quite home. All right. So he gets that far. And verse 22 says that on the third day, Laban was told that Jacob had fled. Taking his relatives with him, he pursued Jacob for 7 days and caught up with him in the hill country of Gilead. Of course, Jacob has to move a lot slower with all the children and animals. And then God came to Laban the Aramean in a dream at night and said to him, be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. That's kind of a profound sort of a rebuke. But Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country of Gilead when Laban overtook him, and Laban and his relatives camped there too. It's not a friendly campground. And then Laban said to Jacob, what have you done? You've deceived me, and you've carried off my daughters like captives in war. Why did you run off secretly and deceive me? Why didn't you tell me so I could send you away with joy and singing to the music of tambourines and harps? You didn't even let me kiss my grandchildren and my daughters goodbye. You've done a foolish thing. I have the power to harm you. But last night, the God of your father said to me, be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. Now you've gone off because you long to return to your father's house. But why did you steal my gods? And that's the final thing that he wants to know. And Jacob answered Laban, listen, I was afraid because I thought you would take your daughters away from me by force. But if you find anyone who has your gods, he shall not live. In the presence of our relatives, see for yourself whether there is anything of yours here with me. And if so, take it. Now Jacob obviously did not know that Rachel had stolen those idols. And so Laban went into Jacob's tent and into Leah's tent and into the tent of the two maidservants. But he found nothing. And after he came out of Leah's tent, he entered Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had taken the household gods and put them inside her camel's saddle and was sitting on them. And Laban searched through everything in the tent but found nothing. Keep in mind, these saddles would become a chair. After they took them off the camel, they'd take it into their tent and it became like furniture. And so she's sitting on what would be a chair in their tent, although it kind of does double duty. And she's sitting there while he's looking through the tent and so forth. And Rachel, in verse 35, said to her father, don't be angry, my lord, that I cannot stand up in your presence. I'm having my period, which was, you know, a lie. So he searched but could not find the household gods. And Jacob was angry and took Laban to task. Oh, Laban's done searching, doesn't find anything. What is my crime? He asked Laban. What sin have I committed that you hunt me down? Now that you have searched through all my goods, what have you found that belongs to your household? Put it here in front of your relatives and mine and let them judge between the two of us. I have been with you for 20 years now. Your sheep and goats have not miscarried, nor have I eaten rams from your flocks. I did not bring you animals torn by wild beasts. I bore the loss myself. And you demanded payment from me for whatever was stolen by day or night. And this was my situation. The heat consumed me in the daytime and the cold at night, and sleep fled from my eyes. It was like this for 20 years I was in your household. I worked for you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flocks, and you changed my wages 10 times. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham and the fear of Isaac had not been with me, you would surely have sent me away empty-handed. But God has seen my hardship and the toil of my hands, and last night he rebuked you. And Laban answered Jacob. He says, the women are my daughters, the children are my children, and the flocks are my flocks. All you see is mine. Yeah, what can I do today about these daughters of mine or about the children they have borne? Come now, let's make a covenant, you and I, and let it serve as a witness between us. And so Jacob took a stone, set it up as a pillar, said to his relatives, gather some stones. So they took stones, piled them in a big heap, and they ate. And Laban called it Jagar Sehadutha, and Jacob called it Galeed. And Jacob said, this heap is a witness between you and me today. And that's why it was called Galeed. And it was also called Mizpah, because he said, may the Lord keep watch between you and me when we are away from each other. If you mistreat my daughters, you take any other wives besides my daughters, even though no one is with us, remember that God is a witness between you and me. And Laban also said to Jacob, here's this heap and here's this pillar I have set up between you and me. This heap is a witness and this pillar is a witness that I will not go past this heap to your side and harm you, and you will not go past this heap and pillar to my side to harm me. I want you to notice here what Laban is doing. He's using words as a way of covering up his own deceptiveness and his own unfaithfulness. And he's really kind of painting a picture of Jacob as the slippery character here, you know. The one who needs all the rules just to be kept in line. And Laban was, you know, trying to paint this picture that, you know, Jacob needed to have a good threatening done to him to kind of get in line and so forth. May the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us. So Jacob took an oath in the name of the fear of his father Isaac, and he offered a sacrifice there in the hill country and invited his relatives to a meal. And after they'd eaten, they spent the night there. And early the next morning, Laban kissed his grandchildren and his daughters and blessed them. And then he left and returned home.